Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Welcome back to Berlin. Good afternoon to Mark Kermode.
Hi, I'm feeling very emotional about this.
Why?
Well, because, you know, as you said, Berlin film location, centre of Europe, and I've been wandering around looking at all the film locations thinking it's just like being in a Wim Wenders movie. And it is. I had a little teary moment earlier on.
Do you know that's just what the Ukrainian and the Tunisian fans were saying to us earlier?
I think that's what they were yelling at me. I didn't quite follow the translation, but it certainly had wings of Berlin.
And
you
were a little bit starstruck when you met Mr. Lineker.
I didn't meet him. I was on the other side and I said, is that really Gary Lineker? And they said, yeah. And that's, I think that's the first sports person I have ever been really, really starstruck by, because it's the first one I've recognised, to be frank.
Reviews coming up for Pretty Persuasion, Aquamarine, Fearless, Half Light, The Lake House. I always say all these films, we never get to half of them. The Wind That Shakes the Barley and Ultraviolet. Berlin as a place for movie locations. You mentioned Wings of Desire. What else that we would know? You know, ordinary people would know.
I think a lot more people would know Wings of Desire than you, because, of course, you, being a total Philistine, fell asleep.
No, I wasn't not appreciating it. It was just...
Oh, right, you appreciated it whilst asleep.
It was just one of those I couldn't help it.
Sort of osmotically.
So, but what else?
Well, I mean, the other obvious one, Cabaret is the one everyone always mentions, Tin Drum. The ones that I would say are the most important ones. There's a lovely horror film called Possession, which is a fantastic piece of work. Really, really strange. It's shot in Berlin. I was going to see if I could find the locations, but apparently that's quite a long way away. Necromantic, the Jörg Butgerite movie that was outlawed in England for such a long time. That was all shot here. Taxi Zum Klo, which is an extraordinary...
Taxi what?
Taxi Zum Klo, which means, literally, taxi to the toilets, which is an extreme art house movie that was outlawed in Britain for quite some time, but is very, very famous by a guy called Frank Riplow, the now late, deceased Frank Riplow. And then more famous stuff, all the Fritz Langs in Metropolis.
When you say an extreme art house...
I mean, it's an art house movie, but it features the kind of imagery that used to not feature in mainstream cinema. It's a story of a young man enjoying himself in Berlin. In the way that only that, you know, that's possible to do.
Fill in the blanks yourself.
But seriously, the central location, because we're just looking at here onto the Brandenburg Gate, and if you go out down, is it called the Fan Mile?
They have miles here, but yeah, I know what you
whatever
mean.
Whatever it is. You walk down the far end of it, and you do get to this thing, which I think is officially called the Victory Column and the Angel of Victory.
Yep.
And which is the thing that you see in Wings of Desire, Wings Over Berlin, of course, in the original title. And I really like that film, and an awful lot of people... There was a point when, if you were a student, you had to have a poster of Wings of Desire on your wall. And it turns out you can go up inside the thing. So I walked up it, all whatever it is, 226 feet of it, 600 feet in, you know, obviously, because I'm 42 and old. And I got, you can stand right at the base of the feet of the Angel of Victory. And I have to say, it was very, very moving. The movingness made no less moving by the Japanese tourists taking photographs of themselves, one of whom very kindly took a photograph of me with literally the Wings of Desire behind me. So I feel that it's made my day. I mean, I'm not being ironic about this. It really has made my day. It's a lovely thing to have done.
Bourne Supremacy was here, wasn't it?
Bourne Supremacy was here. Bourne Ultimatum is going to be here. Tin Drum, obviously. Oh, Just a Gigolo. Did we mention Just a Gigolo? Or was that the one that David Bowie... And, of course, no, I think actually the movie which, for me, I've seen the most time set in Berlin, of course, Christiana F. You remember Christiana F? An extraordinary movie in the 1980s featuring David Bowie in concert about a drug addict, a young girl, and her problems with drugs in Berlin, featuring concert footage and, indeed, a sort of cameo performance by David Bowie himself in which he plays heroes in a stadium here, and it's all shot, you know, amidst the, sort of the undergrowth of Berlin. An extraordinary piece. You've never seen Christiana F?
I've got a feeling I've heard the soundtrack.
Yes, well, I mean, it's, you know, it's
I've probably paid more attention to.
It's all, well, yeah.
I've just got so much catching up to
you
do.
You really have, and you haven't got that long here to do it. So, no, it is extraordinary. It is like one of those cities, like London, like Paris, in which you know it because you know the films, because you've seen so many movies.
If there are other Berlin movies which we should have mentioned, by all means, send us an email. The top 10 box office this week in the UK at 10. Thank You for Smoking. I imagine it's that low because it's just had a limited release.
It will be a limited release. I mean, it's a good film. It's a good little, you know, art
house. Should be harder than 10,
though. No, but it's not as brilliant as some people think it is. It does run out of steam, or puff, as the gag that everyone's made, it runs out of puff.
And it's art house, is it? It's not extreme art house.
No, it's not extreme art house, and it is funny. And if like me, you're a militant anti-smoker, there are some pleasures in it, but it's not up there with, you know, Michael Mann's Inside.
If you're a militant anti-smoker, don't come to Germany.
Oh, no, that's true.
It's about as tough as being a vegetarian.
I had to go...
I mean, life is very, very tough.
I went into a sandwich shop and I thought that I had asked for a sandwich with cheese, but it turns out I asked for a sandwich with Kaiser. which is rather like saying I'd like Margaret Thatcher in a bun. And anyway, they
and
like,
everyone smokes.
Exactly.
Absolutely everyone. It is the law. At nine, The Wild.
Which, you know, it's derivative and nonsense. And I know it's done all right because kids have enjoyed it, but it's rubbish, really.
Your favourite is at number eight. That's RV.
It's, I mean, why? What?
Robin Williams.
I can't believe you just did that gag. Was that...
D-Mob Happy.
Okay, fine. Yeah, but let's just move swiftly on.
Almost going home.
You can listen to that again on the podcast and find out that Simon did just make that gag.
At seven, United 93.
It's just absolutely terrific. I am still surprised that that movie has done as well at the box office as it has done in America. It was a number one hit. Oh, it is absolutely terrific, but it is... you saw it, right?
Yes, absolutely, prior to doing the Paul
Fine, and it is grueling and it is tough, but I do think it has a moral purpose.
Poseidon's at number six, which doesn't.
No, it doesn't. You know, ship goes along, ship turns over, certain people
Most
get
people
out.
Most people die, one person doesn't.
No, but it's of the group. It's like at the beginning. The group is whittled down very quickly to six people, one of whom is Richard Dreyfuss as a jilted gay architect. And he must have been, you know, he came in and his agent went, you know, Richard, you could really do with paying some bills. How about playing a jilted gay architect in the Poseidon Adventure remake? Fine, I'll do that. Ka-ching.
Number five is The Da Vinci Code.
Well, I mean, what is there to say? It's so there's been an
they've had here in Germany,
Das Da Vinci Code.
No, it's the Da Vinci Code sacrilege.
Oh well,
that's the full title.
Closer.
I thought you might approve of that.
There's been a very good article in Sight and Sound
well,
about the fact. No, I'll be very quick.
Good.
That several critics had their ratings for the Da Vinci Code reviews increased by the editors, not the critics. The editors increased them because they thought the critics were being elitist in saying it's a load of pants. And I'd like to congratulate you and the BBC for not in any way telling me not to say it's the worst film of the year.
Well, let's face it, if you're talking it up, we are in a lot of trouble. Hard Candy at four.
I loved it. It's great, terrific to see it going at number four. It's really, really leg-crossing if you like your slasher movies with a real edge, as I did. And as I said before, girls, take your boyfriends to see Hard Candy.
No, don't.
Yes, do,
no,
really. Don't. Really, just to laugh at how much pain they will be in.
There's a relationship that's not going very far.
Oh, incidentally, can I say congratulations, Professor?
Marriage guidance
Professor
counseling.
Linda Williams.
From the Professor and the Doctor. I don't think we need it. The Omen's at three.
Well, you know, the original's available on video, and it's the same film but with bigger stars. And shot-for-shot remake, why bother?
X-Men 3 at two.
You know, there was this correspondence last week with somebody saying, you just don't understand, it's really doing this for the X-Men characters. It's not. The best X-Men movies were helmed by Bryan Singer because those movies had edge. This movie is just a bunch of stuff. However, there is an interesting thing, which is one of the bit part players in X-Men 3 is the lead actress from Hard Candy. So if you're thinking of going to see X-Men 3, may I encourage you to see Hard Candy because it's got the best person from X-Men 3 in it for the whole film.
And the UK's number one, The Fast and the Furious... : Tokyo Drift.
And that just goes to prove that critics cannot stop bad movies from making money. And the next time somebody says to me, you really mean to that film and it really wasn't fair, I'm sorry, look, Da Vinci Code, Fast and the Furious, people kicked those movies to the ground and still they've taken that much money. I mean, you're bringing it upon yourself. If you paid to go and see the Fast and the Furious, you are bringing it upon yourself. Don't come crying to me.
Matt,
yes.
In Salzburg says, can I put in a shout for Goodbye Berlin as a great movie, also bound up in the history of that fabulous city.
But it's very interesting because you asked me before if there's a good film about the Berlin Wall coming down.
I just wonder whether there was a movie in which that was the central event.
Yeah.
Well, it being such an extraordinarily important event in 20th and 21st century.
It is. But Goodbye Berlin is a lovely film in which the main premise of it is that a boy living in Berlin with his mother is ill and he is trying to keep from her the knowledge that the Berlin Wall has come down because she's a diehard communist. And it's a really lovely film. And in many ways, I think it may be the best film about the reunification because it's about pretending that it hasn't happened.
John Patrick and a whole number of other people says, how does Mark manage to so successfully and seamlessly blend his role as your movie critic with his captaincy of Australia?
What? I'm completely lost.
This is because, and thank you also for the photographs that suggesting that you look bafflingly close to Mark Viduka and also Michael Portillo.
Michael Portillo, I know, because he's got the hair thing. So me and Michael Portillo were on Newsnight Review once, and I did think, I wonder what products he uses on his hair. I bet it's not pomade.
John Patrick says, a true omnipotence.
Okay, but is this the guy who is the captain of the...
Of Australia. Next time they're on,
okay.
You watch, tune in. You're doing a fine performance there.
Ask him what he thinks of the Da Vinci Code.
Live from Germany, this is 5 Live at the World Cup.
With Simon Mayo.
Graham in Manchester says, the excellent... is it Stroyzek? Yes, is filmed in Berlin up until he goes to America. Bruno S., who plays him, has his flat in Berlin, and you can see it in the film. But that's, you probably know this, and I wish I was in Berlin, says Graham Rowland.
I really wish that I could go to the place where they shot Possession, though, because that is just the Andrzej Żuławski movie. That is the straight... There's a movie about a woman who has a relationship with a supernatural octopus. And no, and believe me, that undersells its strangeness.
A movie with a supernatural octopus.
And the guy
that I am going to find and rent.
And this is even better. The guy that made the supernatural octopus,
Carlos Rambaldi,
is the same guy that built E.T. He's a guy called Carlos Rambaldi, and he made E.T. and he made the supernatural octopus, like almost back to back.
It occurs to me we should do a movie review. Okay, well, and we've done the top 10, so that's the big stuff.
Sure.
What else is out?
Well, let's start with The Wind That Shakes the Barley, because there's been so much talk and so much fuss about it. Wind That Shakes the Barley, new movie by Ken Loach, deals with Ireland in the early 1920s. It is, as with all of his films, a political story. The story is about two brothers, two Republican brothers, and their struggles, in inverted commas, against the oppressive British regime, which, of course, if you know anything about Irish history, at the 1920s is reaching a crisis point. If you've seen Michael Collins, we're talking about a similar area of history. The two brothers are played by, one of the central one, the main guy, is played by Cillian Murphy. Now, I have to say straight off the bat here, as you know, I am a really big Cillian Murphy fan. I think he's terrific. I think he's a really, really versatile actor. And he does his usual fabulous job in this. The other thing I want to say is that one of the problems with Ken Loach movies is whenever you talk about them, people do exactly what I've just done now, which is to start off by talking about them in a political context, because this is a political movie. It is about the setting up of the Irish Free State, the ructions that causes, and what's sometimes referred to as the Irish Civil War, sometimes referred to as it in, you know, depending on your political perspective. However, what people don't do is refer to them as works of art, because the politics come first. When the movie played at Cannes, the outrage from some members of the British press was terrible. There was one particular columnist who said that the film was absolutely disgusting and disgraceful, despite the fact that he had not seen it. And several of the people that rushed to condemn it had not seen it at all. So the first thing I'd like to say is it is absolutely beautifully shot. Barry Ackroyd, as the cinematographer, has done a wonderful job. The green, verdant hills, the sort of dark brown interiors, the black and blue horrors of war. I mean, it is beautifully put together, and it is beautifully played. It is, however, very political. So if you're not interested in a film which talks about politics, there is going to be a basic problem with The Wind That Shakes the Barley. That's what it does. Land and Freedom, which is my favorite Ken Loach film, which is set during the Spanish Civil War, has this famous section in it in which literally the plot stops. And for the best part of 20 minutes, a group of people argue about the merits of collectivism. Now, some people absolutely hate that. They think it's really boring. I think it's brilliant. I mean, I'm an old lefty anyway, and I think it's really impressive that somebody can reconstruct on camera the way in which people have political arguments. The thing that Ken Loach is interested in is historical moments at which people become politicized. So, of course, people in his films are going to have these kind of discussions. The second thing is that one of the criticisms that's been hurled against the film is that the Brits are all portrayed as bad and horrible and the Irish are all portrayed as lovely. This is not true. This is absolutely not true, because what the film is actually about is an internecine brother against brother struggle. It is about what happens as a result of the decision to sign the treaty when these two brothers split apart. It is a film which has violence in it, and the violence is never shown to be anything other than horrible and ugly and brutal and conflict-riven. It is a film in which two brothers end up clashing heads together. Now, if I have a problem with the film, it is that on the one hand, it has an ultra-naturalist approach to its politics and its history. And, you know, Ken Loach and the writer Paul Laverty have done their research. That's fine. On the other hand, there is a very melodramatic story in the middle of it, which contrives to set these brothers against each other in a way which, for me, is slightly more reminiscent of, you know, Willie Russell. And I think it's slightly too long for its own good, and it doesn't have the emotional clout that some of Loach's best work has. But Loach deserved the Palme d'Or. As a piece of filmmaking, it's a very, very handsome piece of work. We should judge it firstly as a piece of art, and then we should discuss its politics, because that's what the film is attempting to make us do. And I think shame on those columnists, shame on those writers who have come out against Loach without bothering to see the film. Because if, you know, there is a British tradition of filmmaking which is to make controversial films for an international marketplace. This is part of that. You know, don't kick ourselves when we're doing something good.
This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
Five Live.
To find out more about Five Live and its sister service, Five Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live
Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode here in Berlin. Thanks for the emails and texts. This is Neil in Lincoln. He says, Simon, I watched Possession, the supernatural octopus movie Mark loves so much on video, when it was finally re-released on video a few years ago. And Mark is underselling its oddness. Yeah. It's the only film I've ever seen that made less sense the second time I saw it, alongside evil cephalopods. It has Sam Neill as a secret agent, World War III, ballerina twins who aren't twins. My head hurts just thinking about it.
I have to tell you, I love Possession to pieces. I introduced a screening of it at the Tate Modern, or is it the Tate Britain, in London, and I was thrilled because, as happened the time before when I introduced it at the National Film Theatre, somebody fainted and had to be carried out of the film. So that's two screenings I've introduced, and both times somebody's fainted, and I think that is a recommendation for any film.
Neil Child says, Time Out Film Guide lists Possession as not to be seen on a full stomach and Turkey of the Year.
Yeah, but I think actually that review, if I remember rightly, was by... It's not like Nigel Floyd. It's not somebody who's a horror fan. It's not it's a really extraordinary piece of work. It was banned originally under the Video Nasties Act, but it's Isabella Gianni won the Caesar in France for it. The scene in which Isabella Gianni gives birth to the alien monster in the Berlin subway system is really worth seeing.
John in Pontypridd, right, for the final time, Mr. Kermode, X-Men 3 is the conclusion to the first two movies. It is not, I repeat, not a standalone movie in its own right. Therefore, the stuff you refer to is the conclusion itself. Things go boom, things go bang. This story ends after three films, and this is what fans, and I repeat, fans, wanted. Roll on Magneto and Wolverine movies, and the next set of three X-Men movies. May the critics be forever wrong, and may X-Men hit celluloid fever.
There is going to be another X-Men movie, isn't there? It's going to happen, because at the end, the very, very end of X-Men 3, there's a kind of payoff thing when somebody recognises that he's come back from it, you know, and he's looking at the chessboard and it moves, so he hasn't lost all his powers. There will be another one. The box office dictates it.
Just before the next review, John in Middlesbrough, I like this one. This is what makes Mark a professional film critic. He can say Ken and Loach without falling asleep in the middle. Mayo at bbc.co.uk. What else is new?
Okay, so, well, let's move on to The Lake House, because you've already read out a correspondence about The Lake House. What is it with Sandra Bullock? See, I really like Sandra Bullock as a presence. I think she's really nice. She's obviously very funny on screen. She's a good, you know, good comedian and all the rest of it. But she cannot find projects that do her justice. Yes, she backed Crash recently, but then there's Hope Floats and, you know, Forces of Nature and all those terrible films. Anyway, so The Lake House. Listen to this as a pitch. The Lake House is a time-traveling love story featuring a mailbox which acts as a portal between gaps in the space-time continuum, co-starring Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves, who plays a visionary, talented, but troubled architect. Now, I'm sorry, but I mean, even before you start the movie, you think, it's not going to work.
Is there an octopus in it?
There is no octopus in it, and if there was, it would have made things a lot better. The story is, there is the eponymous lake house, meaning the lake house of the title. Sandra,
I know what eponymous means.
You just gave me a look, like, don't come around here saying eponymous. I was going to say titular, but I prefer the word eponymous. Anyway, so it's a glass house. They both live in it together, except, and here's the twist, they are separated by 2 years. Due to a strange Doctor Who-style warp, they are able to communicate with each other by putting letters into a mailbox. Now, it turns out that Sandra can also put scarves into the mailbox that then go back in time, and books that haven't been published yet that then go back in time, without the whole universe imploding. You know how the butterfly effect works?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it doesn't for this. For the purposes of this film, it doesn't. Nor, for the purposes of this film, does Keanu Reeves, the minute he realises that Sandra Bullock is 2 years in the future, say, right, give me the stock prices from now until 2 years hence, because by the time I meet you, I'm going to be a millionaire. No. What he does is, he writes letters to her. Oh, hey, Sandra. I'm a troubled but tortured architect, and I'm finding life really hard. And she writes back, oh, I'm a perky doctor. Things haven't worked out for me. Now, amazingly, this is a remake of a South Korean film, which I haven't seen, called Il Mayor, which apparently is slightly better, although it would have to be hard to be worse. It's absolute balderdash, really badly written by the guy who wrote Proof, incidentally, the stage play of Proof, who has clearly never read a time-travelling book in his life and doesn't understand that there are certain things you can't do, like passing scarves 2 years back. However, all this stuff aside, terrible acting, terrible script, terrible direction, bad idea, badly executed, goes on for ages, awful, awful, awful. The thing that bothered me the most was this. The glass house itself, the lake house, right?
The titular
eponymous lake house, yes. Right? It's made of glass, so you can see
it's
everything.
It's by a lake.
It is by a lake, so it's a glass lake house, right? It's made of glass, so you can see through it. Keanu Reeves keeps going upstairs into an attic. Cut to outside. There is no attic. There is no attic. It's a glass box with no attic. And Keanu, everyone's worrying about the time travel. I'm sitting there going, he's an architect. He's in a glass box. He goes upstairs. He's in an attic that is not connected to that building. It's like he's going, it's not just a temporal warp. He's literally in a TARDIS. He's coming out in another country. Why does it never occur to Keanu, who is allegedly an architect, to look at the building from outside and go, you know what, blimey Charlie, that house has got a lot of things going for it, but one of them isn't an attic.
Do you know why we're very different? I would probably still rather see that than hard candy.
Really?
Yes.
You are. That's, you're so wrong. But
no, because there's no mutilation involved, you know? I mean, on balance, I would rather shout at Keanu.
Actually, can I just say that to say there is no mutilation involved is not quite right. Because the film does open, I'm not giving away anything here, the film does open with somebody being hit by a car. Now, minus 10 points to everybody who doesn't figure out who the person who got hit by the car was at the beginning. Because you know how these films work? I'm sorry, it's a time trap. Yeah, it begins with a moment, they fall in love. Did you see Time After Time? Did you see 12 Monkeys? Did you ever watch any?
Is there an octopus in the lake?
There is no octopus
okay,
in the lake.
That's fine, that's quite enough.
This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is 5 Live in Berlin. Some more suggestions of movies set in Berlin, which should at least get a reference.
Yeah.
This is Gareth, who suggests Berlin Alexanderplatz.
No, it's not to...
Not
doing it for
fancy.
Me.
Still better, Berlin Symphony of 1000.
Okay.
He's making these up, isn't he? Plus, East German-made subversive film, Paul and Pauletta. Not sure about the spelling. A real indictment, he says, of the bureaucratic demolition of old housing blocks in Berlin and the loss of a humane political system more generally.
Well, it's interesting. If you go to the IMDb...
Is he suggesting that the East German political system was actually humane?
I don't think so. If you go to the IMDb and put in Berlin's location, it comes up with something like 2,000 titles, about 1,000 of which are hardcore pornography.
Well, maybe that's what he's recommending.
Well,
anyway.
Never know.
Okay, so we've done you Lake House. That sounds a winner. The Wind That Shakes the Barley, what else?
Well, the other thing that's out with, you know, I was saying it's a problem, Sandra Bullock can't find a movie to, you know, show off her talents. So here's Demi Moore. Remember Demi Moore, who used to be called Gimme Moore because she was the person who got $20 million for doing things like G.I. Jane?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, fine. Well, she's back in this thing called Half-Light, which is an unbelievably stupid, derivative, awful, nonsensical chiller that in America wasted no time going onto the DVD shelves and here will just trouble the cinemas only passingly before it turns up in your local Blockbuster. Story is, Demi Moore is a best-selling novelist living in London. How do we know this? Well, one, we get a shot of the gherkin, which we always do, and two, we get a montage of newspaper headlines saying, you know, very successful novelist, doing really well, living in London. Another hit, so that's fine. Beginning, there's a tragedy. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but if you've seen Don't Look Now, if you've seen the opening 5 minutes, it's that. It's that tragedy done badly. So she decides to go away. Where's she going to go to? She's going to go to Scotland. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but if you've seen The Wicker Man, it's that Scotland that she goes to. In fact, they film it in Wales, but it's meant to be Scotland. There's lots of, you know, villagers going, oh, And everyone in the pub is from the cast of American Werewolf in London. You know, she comes in, piano stops playing, everyone turns around, darts fall on the floor. Oh, no, we don't like strangers around here, although they don't say it in that accent, they do it in a Scottish accent, despite the fact they're in Wales.
I'm getting a number of people liking your impression, particularly your Keanu Reeves impression, and suggesting that I should allow you to do more.
Thank you very much. Very good. Then she gets on a boat. She goes to a lighthouse, right? She goes to a lighthouse, because of course you'll go to a lighthouse because you're suffering, you're a novelist, and she meets this guy who's a little bit weird, a little bit strange, a little bit fey, a little bit no one's seen him on the mainland for quite some time. You're thinking, I know, I saw Sixth Sense, but there's a twist. It's not quite Sixth Sense. It's the other rubbish movie. It's Final Analysis. You know, the one with Kim Basinger and Richard Gere running up the lighthouse and falling off, and you think, I saw that Hitchcock movie years ago and this is a lot worse. It's nonsense, and the only interest in it at all is literally sitting there going, yep, saw that, thank you, can I go home now? And it will not be in cinemas very long at all.
By the way, for future reference, when you say, and I'm not going to spoil it for you,
I just did.
You do?
Yes.
Okay, what else?
But actually, that's not fair, you know. Somebody said recently that I had spoiled something about the Japanese movie Audition, that I had spoiled the plot of the Japanese movie Audition simply by quoting the line, and now the left leg. I'm sorry, if you can figure out the plot of Audition from the line, and now the left leg, then you are cleverer than I am. Moving on.
Yes.
Aquamarine. Now, the reason that I'm even going to bring Aquamarine up is because you and I have had a little bit of a set-to in the past about movies that are aimed at, I think they're now referred to as teenagers. you know, girls between the age of 8 and 12. Is that the correct term?
No idea. It's just made up by people who make up words, isn't it?
Okay,
so
fine.
Call it what you want.
So, Aquamarine, a story about two tweenagers, two young girls, one of whom looks exactly like Lindsay Lohan looked 10 years ago. And what a shocking thought to think that Lindsay Lohan is now too old to play the movies featuring people that look like Lindsay Lohan. They're on their last summer together on a beach because one of them's got to go and move to Australia. They keep going on about how terrible it is that she has to move to Australia, despite the fact the film is actually made in Australia, which is, must have worked out peculiarly with the tourist board. And they meet a mermaid. Now, look, I'm going to attempt...
This is going to be a compulsory Mayo family movie, I know it.
Yeah, well, You see, the thing is that there's one... There's something saying, OK, it's not made for me, it's made for a teenage audience that would enjoy... However... It's Splash, right? But it's not Splash. Splash is a wonderful movie. Splash is in my top 20 movies of all time. I absolutely love it. I've shown Splash to my daughter, who's 7. She loves it as well. It's fantastic. If you want to see great, you know, great mermaid movie, Splash is the one. It doesn't matter how old you... You've seen Splash,
yes,
right?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, and it's just lovely,
it's
right?
A boring bit at the beginning.
There's not a boring bit at the beginning. What are you talking about? It starts with them singing Hully Gully or Wooly Bully.
If you think Parent Trap is the world's greatest movie,
right,
what are you going to think of this?
I think that you're going to think that you've been shortchanged. Because I'm sitting...
It's not as good as Parent Trap.
No, it's not as good as Parent Trap. And I know that, you know, again, you and I had a big falling out about the Parent Trap. But I am willing to accept that if Parent Trap works for a certain age of teen girls, then that's absolutely fine and it hits its target audience. I am also willing to bet that the problem with Aquamarine, which I just thought was yuck, and Sarah Paxton as the mermaid is yuck, the problem with it is that it underestimates the intelligence, the wit, the imagination of its target audience. Fine, yes, they're 8 to 12-year-old girls. It doesn't mean they're stupid. It means that they're, you know, they're 8 to 12-year-old girls. It means that there's a certain way in which you can talk to them that isn't like hitting them over the head with an old VHS of a movie that you are desperately hoping that their parents haven't seen before. I mean, if you go and... Here's the thing. If you're a parent and you take your daughter to see Aquamarine, and incidentally, very good for taking kids to the movies because it's a very good thing. People aren't doing it enough anymore. That's a good thing. As you walk out, shout very loudly, yes, but it's not as good as Splash, and then take them home and show them Splash. That's the way to do it. Splash is the...
It's the end of narrative cinema. Still...
Well, the end of narrative cinema is to get a date, yes. But I'm assuming that if you're taking the kids to the movie, that's not...
No, but you could impress other parents, though, couldn't you?
Well, that's absolutely fine. But that's it. It's not Splash. I mean, it's really not Splash. It's Splosh. It's Stunk. It's Stunk.
Isn't Stunk a German movie?
It is a German movie, but it is amazingly enough... did I tell you this already? I'm having a terrible sense of déjà vu about this.
Yes, you did, but we weren't on the air at the time.
Oh, fine, okay. Stonk is the biggest selling German comedy ever made in Germany, and it's about the faking of the Hitler Diaries scam. And
sounds hilarious.
And it was a review to which several people, Stonk, wrote the review, Stunk, ba-boom.
And that was it.
And so Splash, Splosh, sorry. Can I do one more very quickly?
Simon, tell Mark that eponymous and titular should only refer to characters and not titles.
Says who?
Says... Jim and Jan Rayner on this email. You've got
eponymous means of the title.
You've got about 30 seconds.
Okay, Ultraviolet. All I need to say about it is this, okay? If Aeon Flux was the Matrix for pervy fetishists, then Ultraviolet is Aeon Flux for total no-brain numbskulls. Apparently, it was 2 hours long originally, and the studio butchered it to 87 minutes. Well, all I can say is they didn't butcher enough.
Mark, thank you. It's Wimbledon next week, so we'll see you there.
Okay.
Germany 2006. No one gets you closer to the World Cup than 5 Live. And if you want to get even closer, sign up for our new daily 5 Live Wire. A roundup of the news and gossip from Germany, from our correspondents, the teams, the training camps, and the treatment rooms. Plus, you can tell us how, when, and where you'll be experiencing the World Cup and what you know about the teams that we don't. To get 5 Live Wire delivered to your inbox before the first game each day, go online bbc.co.uk/5live.